I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This is Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you're one of our patrons, you're beautiful. Thank you for being here. And this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. But if you're not yet a patron but would like to get our ad-free extended versions or listen and interact with us live, please head to patreon.com/UK tech. And hello to our newest patrons since the last show, Peter Shakeshaft and David Morris. Thank you very much for joining us since last week's episode. Great to have you with us. And thank you for keeping us in a supply of clean towels and hot meals. It's very much appreciated, isn't it, Ian?
It is, absolutely, yeah. We love those clean towels.
And those hot meals.
Well, they're a part of life.
They are. And other things that are parts of life include Facebook hiring former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg as the head of its global affairs and communications team. This, according to the BBC writing this week. The 51-year-old politician was leader of the Liberal Democrats and formed a coalition government, as we will all fondly remember, with David Cameron and the Conservatives in 2010. Now, Clegg's new job title will be Vice President of Global Affairs and Communications at Facebook. That's a longer word for lobbying man. And he's going to start working there on Monday before moving to California with his family permanently in the new year. Now, we're going to discuss this a little bit, but I did spend some time thinking about this week, and I kind of think that it's not difficult to see why Facebook would want to hire a European politician at the moment. The company's under fire from regulators and politicians and other authorities here and around Europe, and, you know, and to be fair, around the world as well, for anything from privacy breaches to its role in the spread of fake news and election rigging and hate speech on its platforms. Plus, Clegg has the benefit of not only speaking English, but also French, Dutch and German, which will be very handy. And then here, more locally in the UK, Facebook is also under investigation for letting the data of millions of users end up in the hands of Cambridge Analytica, which, of course, we've discussed at length over the last few months. And as a bit of a brief reminder, yes, Nick Clegg led the Liberal Democrats into government with then Tory leader David Cameron, because he needed more MPs to make a government. What do they call it? A hung parliament, I think, isn't it?
Exactly. Or they didn't have they didn't have a clear majority to get things through.
Yeah, and we had that in the snap election that Theresa May called, and she had to line up with the DUP, wasn't it, in Ireland. But the Tories had to buddy up with the Liberal Democrats. And it was a really controversial coalition. I mean, for Clegg in particular, most notably, I think, when he ended up apologising for not blocking a rise in student tuition fees, which had been a key part of his manifesto ahead of the election. And then in the 2015 general election, the Liberal Democrats were reduced from almost 60 seats to fewer than 10, and Clegg subsequently resigned. So that was the last we sort of really knew about what Clegg was up to. And that all sounds kind of bad, but I kind of think Clegg's got this sort of experience to a certain extent that Facebook needs. He's also actually been a pretty staunch defender of the company in the past. If you Google Nick Clegg Facebook, for stories older than a week ago, there's an interesting piece you can find for one of the UK newspapers. I think it was The Eye. And he really took the company's side in a column, and he wrote, "It's time we pause for breath before everyone charges off in a stampede of condemnation of tax-dodging, fake news, extremism-promoting, data-controlling tech firms. The unthinking mood of hostility could soon topple into outright Luddism against new forms of technology." That's a pretty damning praise for Facebook.
But it's also nonsense, isn't it, really?
Well, to a large extent, yes, depending on which side of the fence you sit.
I sit on the side of the truth, in fact. And the reality is that Facebook is and continues to do untold damage to us, both politically and personally.
Let's come to that in a moment, because I had one final point I wanted to make about Nick Clegg, which is that the hiring of him by Facebook helps answer the question I think a lot of people have, which is, what does a politician do after politics other than after dinner speeches and book deals? The answer, it turns out, to be work for a giant company that'll most likely pay you a salary in order of magnitude higher than you'd get from the public purse, / the Queen. So that's where we are. He's going to start working the new year properly, but really start getting the wheel spinning up from next week. So, Ian, thoughts? Are you a Clegg fan? Are you a Clegger?
Not really. I mean, I don't really care, and I don't know why anyone does care about what he does for a job. I mean, I've seen some condemnation of it. Can't raise any enthusiasm for it, frankly. Like all politicians, they often end up using it as a springboard. You know, they'll do their time on the benches of Parliament, and then they'll, you know, get a better paid job when one comes along. It's happened time and time again, and it will continue to happen, because people don't actually care about the country. They just, you know, like the power.
Well, he before he was in politics, he was a journalist at the FT.
Well, then he should care about truth, shouldn't he?
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, obviously it's a complicated matter, but this isn't about the truth, is it? This isn't about, you know, making Facebook a better company. It's about them understanding how regulation works in the UK, particularly. I wouldn't be surprised if they made other hires from other countries that follow the same pattern. And it means that they will then understand what will and will not be tolerated, and they'll have access to lobby. So, again, really, it's got, you know, very little to do with the truth of truth. It's everything to do with one man getting a good paycheck and some more power, and Facebook trying to stemmy the flow of blood from its severed artery of honesty and decency.
They should put that on the posters, mate.
They should. They should. I mean, I'm almost getting sick and tired of writing about Facebook, because if it's not one thing, it's the next. It's an absolutely ludicrous company.
But it's sort of unavoidable when a company has such an enormous amount of influence. I mean, it's far more influential in many ways than governments, you know, and other lobbyists. If you look
well,
at how governments try and convince
than government.
People around the world to, you know, to agree with their policies and get them voting, very little has as much impact as social media. And in fact, I think, and I hate to talk about Donald Trump on our show, but I do remember reading, I think it was this week, it might have been the week before, Taylor Swift made a post on Instagram about rallying, you know, her supporters to vote. And I read somewhere that something like 150,000 new voters were registered in her Tennessee district, specifically as a result, they think, of Taylor Swift making a post about it. So, you know, that sort of shows you the kind of power that, I mean, obviously for her, a very highly followed celebrity, but also just the reach that these platforms have. So in a sense, it kind of makes sense for companies to be hiring politicians. As to whether Nick Clegg's going to do the job that Facebook needs it to do from a PR standpoint, I suppose remains to be seen.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think it's anything like that. I mean, I think he will absolutely be valuable to them. And I don't think that will be necessarily something we'll be particularly aware of. I don't think he's going to be seen a lot. I don't feel like that's how it's going. Especially if he's moving to America, he's not going to be the British face of Facebook's publicity department, is he? He's going to be, you know, giving them information and helping them make inroads with government.
I think with a company the size of Facebook, with the travel budget that it has, he'll be making frequent trips to the UK. I mean, think about just the kind of committees that we've seen holding inquiries in the UK with Damian Collins at the DCMS grilling Facebook executives. I mean, they still want to get Zuckerberg in front of them. And I can just see this as being a fantastic way for Collins to convince Zuckerberg to appear finally in a committee hearing by calling up Nick Clegg and saying, dude, tell your boss to put down his shotgun or whatever he hunts animals with, because he loves to do that, apparently. Get on a plane, come here, and tell us about Cambridge Analytica, please. That seems like a no-brainer.
Well, I mean, yeah, but ultimately, what's the point? We've already had an inquiry into the Russians meddling in Brexit. And the answer was, we can't do anything about foreign powers who decide to impede British democracy. So it doesn't really make any difference, does it?
It's done.
It's done now. It's not going to get any better. All we can really hope for is that, we just have to hope that Facebook does the right thing and protects its users from this sort of thing happening again.
Yeah. Well, any thoughts you have, of course, do send them to us, hello@techpodcast.uk, or leave us some thoughts on Twitter @textmessagepod.
You're listening to Text Message with Nate Langson. Do you have someone sitting next to you? Yes? Why not tell them about the show? You never know. Your new best friend and our newest listener could be just an awkward conversation away.
Some online sellers, Ian, are offering people free things in return for positive product reviews. This is according to an investigation by consumer group Which, according to a BBC write-up this week. And the Beeb said that Which's investigator joined several rewards for reviews groups and was hired to write high-rated reviews in return for free items. This is interesting because almost always this kind of thing is against the policy of online sellers and platforms. The investigator gave an honest review of the items, the BBC wrote. But in 3 out of 5 cases, the investigator was not refunded for the purchase because the reviews were not positive enough or the seller could no longer be contacted. Which said that in one example, the investigator gave a smartwatch a 2-star review and they were told by the seller to rewrite it because the product was free. So it is, quote, the default to give 5-star evaluation. I wanted to include this in our story for 2 reasons, Ian. 3 if you include the fact that it's just interesting. But the first is that this is a kind of no S Sherlock sort of issue. This has been happening for years and years, if not decades, if you include print media prior to the internet. But also, you know, you and I really cut our teeth in the technology world as technology reviewers at CNET. And this kind of story reminds me of the benefit that we hopefully gave consumers writing reviews for a site like CNET that has a good reputation. And now so much of the reviewing world is confined to user-generated content on shopping platforms themselves or across social media, things like that. And, you know, it's very difficult now, I think, for consumers to necessarily know who to trust. There's too much noise and too little obvious signal. What do you reckon?
Well, I mean, I absolutely agree. I mean, it isn't a good idea for people to be reviewing things that they've either been given for free or that they have bought themselves in many ways. I've always said that people who buy things aren't good, you know, bellwethers for whether the product is good, because obviously a lot of the time they've spent money and then they'll sort of trick themselves into thinking it's better than it is in a lot of cases. I mean, you know, you'll see that with the defense of some very average products. But I don't have as much problem with that as I do with, you know, the idea of giving away free products. I wrote a story about this that was also on the BBC about Amazon and its Vine program, whereby Amazon's sort of been accused of switching that program somewhat, because originally it was designed for people to review third-party products. So they would do a deal with, say, Gillette and get some razors. And then they would be expected to review that product on Amazon. It would be flagged as a Vine review. And then, but the people would never come in contact with the companies. Amazon would be the intermediate and they would deal with getting the product, shipping it to the customer. And then the customer's free to say what they want. So in theory, actually quite a good idea, because I mean, you know, obviously there are professional reviewers in the world, and this is a cheaper way of actually paying people to review products, and it's more likely that the public will find those favourable. The argument was that as Amazon has increasingly encroached into providing its own products through the Amazon Basics range and stuff like that, it was sending those out through the Vine program, and it was therefore not then... the people weren't then one step removed from the company that was providing the product. They were dealing directly with it. So they felt, even if they weren't told, they felt like they had to review it in a positive light, perhaps giving, you know, a far more favorable score than the product actually deserved. So, I mean, I'm sure there are ways of doing good online, you know, reviews by customers. You can learn a lot about stuff, but it's very difficult to take them seriously. There's a lot of stuff that you could buy where people just don't necessarily understand the product properly. They may well have paid for it themselves, but they might have a fundamental misunderstanding of what it does when they bought it or whatever. And that can affect products either in a good way or a bad way. But ultimately, I do not believe that this particular idea of paying for reviews or rewarding people for reviews with expensive free products is a particularly good idea. And I also believe it would be, well, if not illegal, probably fall foul of some legislation.
Definitely. I mean, it reminds me of a lot of the controversy we have about celebrities promoting products that they're paid to promote without flagging them as ads or promotions. And KV raises an interesting point in the chat room as we're talking here, which is that some people review within the honeymoon period. And actually, a lot of professional reviewers will review within a similar type of honeymoon period. You know, you get the product home and you're very happy with it for the first two or three days. You're very excited. So you write a very excited review. But sometimes those reviews would be quite different, maybe 3 months down the line when a product's had its time to wear in and possibly even wear out. Certainly happened to me when I started buying electric scooters. The first two that I bought were you know, very good to the extent that I actually recommended one of them to one of our regular listeners in the Discord in the chat room. I won't name him by name because I don't want to embarrass him, because I know he fell off one of them. But I didn't fall off one, but two of them did break and I sent them back and they were terrible. And if I'd have written the review within the first 3 days, I'd have probably said, yes, good value, you know, goes a decent speed, it's fantastic. But if I'd have written the review when I sent them back, I would have said, reprehensible product, broke in the same way two times within 6 weeks, do not buy, avoid. And then bought a better one. But we had this problem when we were doing reviews as well, Ian, because a lot of companies, even for the professional reviewers, like us and others like us, sometimes companies, you know, the way it works, a company will send out the product for review, you know, to you, and they want them back when you're done with them. But sometimes you're only given, I mean, sometimes a matter of days, and sometimes less even than that, to write usually quite a lengthy review and do photography and probably a video review in recent years as well. And it's very, very difficult to be truly objective or as objective as you'd like in that period. You know, I've had loans of products for literally 2, maybe 3 days. There've been, you know, before the review had to be published or before the product had to be sent back. Apple as well, in the times where I've reviewed something ahead of its release date or ahead of its the embargo lifting for the reviews, you might have a couple of days sometimes to go through it, and that's difficult, particularly when you're factoring in the time that you're having to write maybe a 1,000-word review as well. It's not a lot.
You're not going to catch stuff in that period. No, it's completely true, and there is a definite market for long-term reviews, but the problem is that no one will read them because that's not how the internet works. You know, everyone will go for the embargo and they'll have their thoughts on it, and it will. You know, and it can often take a while for people to discover that there are problems with things. So, I mean, there's no solution to that.
I like the XKCD comic that Luke has shared in the chat room. I think I remember seeing this one. It's a cartoon about a pretend tornado guard. Average rating of 4 stars out of 5 based on 4 reviews. User reviews at the top, number 5, good. Make alert. Or many alert choices. I can't quite see here. Yes, many alert choices. And then at the bottom, 1 star, app did not warn me about tornado. Quite a discrepancy there.
Yes. And you know, and that is true of star ratings, particularly. If you're going to, you know, have an average kind of from various things, you will always end up with the same score, essentially. Well, not that you won't end up with the same score, but it ultimately, unless a product is absolutely terrible or very, very good, it will always land on, you know, 3 or 4 stars, won't it?
Well, let us know how you find a trustable review. I think this would be an interesting one to throw out to the audience. Do let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk or @textmessagepod on Twitter. If you're buying a product, how do you go and find a trustable review? What's your source? Be great to find that out. Hello@techpodcast.uk.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UKTech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
In a letter published by The Guardian, the heads of ITV, BBC, Channel 4 and Channel 5, for those of you not in the UK, there are big broadcasters, urged the UK's government to require tech companies to give them more prominent placement within on-demand services, Engadget wrote this week, and explained that the bosses... I say explained, The Guardian explained, that the bosses had argued that public service channels are trustworthy news sources, innovative and of local relevance. They wanted new rules to guarantee that these channels' outputs would remain easy to find in a world, to be fair, increasingly dominated by the likes of Netflix and Amazon, with people discovering content less by looking at a TV guide or the Radio Times or whatever way you used to use TV discovery systems, and instead rely on algorithms to recommend stuff that's very similar to things they've watched before or recently. Now, I've read this letter several times, and actually... what seems to be being called for here is far more than just getting streaming services to give BBC and friends better placement within Netflix, for example. They essentially seem to want technology companies themselves, and they do mention Apple and Google by name as just two companies, to make sure that this content of theirs is given top billing or easy discovery from the software interfaces of their products. So it's not just about going into Netflix and having Netflix show you... Sherlock at the top of the screen. It's about loading up an Apple TV or a Kindle Fire or similar and being shown the BBC app or at least some BBC content as well as Netflix and Amazon and things like that. And it reminds me a little bit as well, this argument of when public broadcasters said that they wanted to appear within iPlayer. This is going back, you know, probably 6, 7, 8 years. But do you remember, Ian, we were talking about this years and years ago about how ITV and Channel 4 were annoyed that the iPlayer was so dominant and they wanted listing. And eventually, I think they did, at least for a while, around 2011, 2012, you could go onto the iPlayer and at least in terms of the TV listings, like what's coming up, it would list Channel 5 and ITV 4 and all these other things. And you could they would link out to their relevant catch-up services or similar. I did take a look for that before we started recording and it doesn't seem to be available anymore, but it just feels like this keeps coming full circle. And now, instead of local broadcasters being angry at the BBC's dominance, it's all of our public service broadcasters being angry at Netflix or Apple or whomever. So give me your take, Ian, before I jump in with my own. What do you think of this?
I don't really understand, honestly. I don't see how anyone can expect private companies to obey their wishes like this. Netflix and the like have been built up through arguably the hard work of their employees, and it's a business. And why should then a public service broadcaster come along and say, actually, no, we want to be, you know, or even a, you know, non-public service broadcast, I guess, come along and say, no, we want top billing because, you know, this is the UK, people want our content. That doesn't work for me as an idea. And I also don't know what it really adds to a user experience. Presumably, if you were super, super keen on watching Doctor Who, you probably would do it on iPlayer rather than on Netflix. What does this add to a customer perspective beyond boosting broadcasters? Now, obviously, I would like the broadcast world to be healthy and keep producing amazing shows. And I think they will continue to do that because that's ultimately what the public wants and where the money is. But I don't think you can force other businesses to sort of obey that. Arguably, we'll probably see a time where Netflix won't want any content from anyone else. It will, its long-term goal will almost certainly be to produce all of its own content. Obviously, that might be a very long-term goal.
I have heard that Netflix wants half of its its catalogue to be original programming.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't it? It's much more cost effective if you produce it yourself. Netflix knows a lot better than anyone what people watch. This is why Adam Sandler comedies are continually commissioned by Netflix, because they know that people are searching for Adam Sandler, and that doesn't have any bearing on the perceived quality of that. But it does give Netflix the option of understanding its audience in a way that most broadcasters just simply can't. And therefore, I think as time goes on, they will always cherry pick some really good stuff from other places. Or they may just grow to such a size that they're doing, you know, that they're able to afford to take on, you know, as many big budget films as they want, but that they're really, their almost entire focus is going to be on their own produced content, because, again, you know, that's where the money is. They could then, you know, sublicense it or whatever. It's a complicated relationship, but I suspect Amazon, Netflix, Hulu, etc. are all pushing towards owning everything.
You see, I would have disagreed with the suggestion that the broadcasters couldn't push for this to happen. Were it not for the fact that we've had this European law now that says that the companies like Netflix and Amazon have to produce and promote and make visible a certain percentage, you know, around 30% original content on their platforms for, you know, for or from local countries in Europe, and spend money in the creation of those works. That is a direct result, essentially, of these countries' media producers basically saying we can't compete with this. So they legislate and they say, right, well, if you're going to be this dominant, then you have to basically foot the bill of making sure that these broadcasters and studios don't go out of business, because no one wants to watch them in a traditional way.
Well, I would say that actually, I think that's probably some of the benefit to Netflix. I mean, I don't know how much stuff they do in the UK. There's some. I mean, Black Mirror is arguably a British production.
The Crown,
yeah. But there's more than you'd think, actually, mate.
There really are quite a lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, you'd hope that would be the case. And I think that you will never break into a country as a service that has mass appeal unless you're using that country's voice to speak to its people. I mean, you know, there are some, I mean, I think The Crown is popular all over the world. I think Black Mirror is popular all over the world. But there will be other things, littler shows that Netflix could easily do that maybe other broadcasters won't. And those could be a huge way to expand its audience, to hook in people who would be actually, you know what, otherwise I don't think anyone else would make this, I'm going to subscribe. It's a very good example of that is Sky Arts, which exists probably not so much in a profit-making sense as a way to hook in a certain kind of customer to Sky. You know, Sky Arts shows a lot of stuff like opera and ballet and stuff like that that doesn't really work on mainstream broadcasters. But, of course, it gives Sky an almost exclusive amount of access to a more, I'm not going to say wealthy, because I don't think that's the truth. I think it gives them access to a different kind of viewer, which then benefits them because they have an audience that's slightly. Well, how do I put it? I suppose if you run a news operation and you want to have influence, then you need to bring people to your platform who perhaps otherwise would avoid it. So what I'm saying is, if you think of a politician perhaps is interested in XYZ, if you can get them in on that idea and then feed them some news, all the better.
Or just hire Nick Clegg.
Or that.
You know, while you're promoting your own original content and video streaming capabilities. Well, not insinuating that's the reason, of course. He's a comms guy now. Stephen Huxtable actually wrote in with an email that we were going to come to you next week, but it's so perfectly timed that I'm going to actually read it now straight from the inbox. He said that both Netflix and Amazon have taken a substantial slice of viewer numbers away from traditional broadcasters here in the UK. With Netflix arriving on the Sky platform in November and on-demand options becoming the norm, the lines between terrestrial and online service have never been more blurred. And I'd agree with that, because actually, if you think about it, if everything's going through a kind of a set-top box, or even something like an Apple TV like we have here at home, you know, even our terrestrial type content comes through, you know, comes through the internet, it's going to become less obvious what's a terrestrial broadcast in origin and what is an on-demand thing and what's a catch-up service and what's something else.
And that argument perhaps makes a different point in that it's actually not Netflix that the problem is. It's the people who make the hardware who need to be, you know, who could be the gatekeepers. If you look at something like Shield or Apple TV, what you're presented with on the home screen is often a collection of things it's found for you on different services. I don't think it's particularly smart in those two particular examples. But if you think about that, the value of that gateway is far more probably than it is just forcing Netflix to put BBC shows at the top of a list.
And well, Stephen points out as to be fair, that I mean that's basically as well what I think the letter was calling for in the very, you know, when we start talking about it, is that, you know, they're not suggesting that it should just be like Netflix should put a BBC program on the front page when you load Netflix. It's that Apple should be, or all of these device makers should be making these types of services, whether it's public broadcasting, whether it's streaming from a US giant, as visible as each other, and to keep that visibility high as they update their software. But Stephen also raised another interesting point about how streaming companies are taking on roles that we would previously only associate with terrestrial stuff. He mentions tennis and football being shown on Amazon UK and Big Brothers apparently rumored to be going to Netflix after being cancelled by Channel 5. So it's like there's a lot of those things that are being picked up now, and the rights are being competed for on such an extraordinarily expensive scale that often the only companies that are going to be able to pay to have a lot of these live sporting programs could well be the likes of Amazon and Netflix and Apple. Like, they're the ones with the huge back pockets compared to even BT and Sky. But if you're listening and have found that your ears pricked up and you have an incredibly salient point to make, you know what to do, don't you? You open an email client. You start a new email. You put hello@techpodcast.uk in the to line, and then you bash away with your fists on your giant keyboard, and then press send. And we'll look forward to reading those comments next week. Ian, it's time to dive into our mailbag for this week. We've got two or three very interesting things that came in. I'm going to start with something that we had coming through on Twitter at TextMessagePod. This is from @MrProtozoa. He says, regarding day one patches, what about game preservation? If I pick up a 10-year-old game off my shelf and the servers are deprecated, I'm stuck with an incomplete experience, which is especially bad for single-player narrative titles. It's very true.
It's not even just a problem with really old games. I've bought games that are available on like Uplay that don't work. I've tried to raise that with Ubisoft, and they want, they don't care. So you can actually buy a game on that service, which is completely broken.
I think it is terrible. And I think because a lot of DLC is released long after the games have shipped, you might not be able to get those. I actually remember this came up once when I bought this is going back some time, ladies and gentlemen, but Final Fantasy IX on the PlayStation 1, I bought the official game guide for that. And it was at the time where the publisher really, really wanted people to utilize their website as well, because this was the late 90s. And so I went, I was going through this guide, and there were certain points where the information wasn't even in the book. It said, go to this website and type in this code. And that was great until I was replaying the game several years later and the website didn't exist. And I was like, well, this is totally rendered this book redundant. That's the reason I bought a book. But, you know, hopefully we'll find places that can somehow build a business off the back of supporting this. A little bit like Good Old Games does for a lot of old games that don't really have any way to be sold other than, obviously, Steam. But it
yeah,
could be
and
a
they're
business
all DRM-free, aren't they, when they're on GOG?
On GOG they are, yeah. They are. And then we wanted to come to an interesting couple of points we had, and this is the last time we're going to talk about this on the show, from people who have sent in their iPhone pickup counts. We've been curious to see what the average is for everybody. One came in from Shivanshi, and Shivanshi is from Australia, which is great, or at least based in Australia. Shivanshi says, their average pickups were 47 per day, So that's definitely lower than we've had from other listeners. To put this into context, I'm using an iPhone SE. I'm not on any social media except as a consumer of YouTube, and I'm actively trying to reduce my usage. Over the last few years, I've weaned myself off social media as I found I was not only mindlessly scrolling through pages and pages of feeds, which I would not even remember an hour later, but I would end up getting into arguments with friends on Facebook over differences of opinion and would be needlessly outraged for some tweet from someone I didn't know. Well, I think you can relate to Ian Morris there. There's nothing worse than somebody being wrong on the internet.
I wish they always are.
Always. Except us, mate. We're always flawless.
Another relevant XKCD there.
Indeed. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I had that on a T-shirt at one point. Or a similar one. Anyway, Shivanshi continues. Most importantly, though, is that I found myself not spending as much time as I would like with my family. Since then, I'm more engaged with my family, keep closer contact with friends, although not as numerous as the hundreds I had on Facebook. I can honestly say they are friends, and currently reading books again. This is just my little story. I hope it helps. I know everyone's relationship with technology is different. That's Shivanshi. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, very good email. It's XKCD386 if you want to look it up.
Someone is wrong on the... Oh, yeah, it's like, come to bed, dear. It's like, I can't. Yeah. Somebody is wrong on the internet. Yeah, I remember that one. It's great. And then the last message we had, Ian, why don't you take this? Because I've got a conflict of interest here.
It's from Nate's mum. That's why. Hi, in the last 7 days, I averaged 2 hours, 22 minutes per day. Most used were Google, 4 hours, 16 minutes. WhatsApp, 4 hours and 5 minutes. And that's 347 pickups, but an average of 49 per day, which is very low.
Yes. And she said probably higher than usual due to being off work at the moment.
Yes, exactly. And that's absolutely right. And I think that might explain the WhatsApp, because obviously you and Andy will be regularly checking in to make sure she's doing okay. So, yes, probably much lower usage than us phone addicts.
Yes, love the show. Regards, your mother. Thank you, mother.
We'd be in trouble if your mother wasn't a fan, wouldn't we?
We'd be in huge trouble, yes.
I don't like your show, Nate.
Yes, I think you should stop doing this.
Yeah. Well, we would listen if she had any specific feedback.
Yeah, I'd get her on the show one day at some point. She's got.
Hasn't she already been on the show at some point? I'm sure that...
Not on purpose, if she has,
right.
I'm sure.
Okay.
But we'll find out. You can petition to have my mother come on the show and talk about how she uses her phone. hello@techpodcast.uk. Thank you, mother, and thank you, Shivanshi, and also thank you, Mr. Protozoa, on Twitter for your feedback. Text message, of course, keeps you informed about the British tech landscape, but let's check in with Tom Merritt over at Daily Tech News Show in the US and hear what's been happening in the wider world of tech over the last week.
Hey, thanks. This week on Daily Tech News Show, it's kind of cloud week. We started off talking about all of the Adobe announcements about their new creative cloud products like Premiere Rush that lets you do some video editing for a little cheaper than buying the full version of Premiere. That led to talking about video game machines in the cloud and whether latency has gotten good enough to be able to rely on that and how Patrick Beja thinks it might be the future. And we even talked with Scott Johnson about using the cloud for everything. Could it be that you just don't need to replace your hardware anymore? All that and a lot more at dailytechnewsshow.com.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, definitely worth a listen if you're interested in how cloud-based technologies are developing. It's actually amazing to me how quickly a lot of this stuff has developed. I mean, if you think back, say, 10 years or so when the iPhone was released, could we imagine then that 10 years later we'd have literally terabytes of cloud storage available to us for like a few quid a month, or smartphones with mobile connections faster than many people have for their fiber optic home broadband?
Yeah, I think I would struggle with that concept more than I would with the cloud storage. I mean, I suppose if you just explained it to me, you went, oh, well, they've worked out how to store all this on the cloud instead, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But I don't... the whole idea of, you know, fast internet on the phone is something I think would have surprised 10 year ago me.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Tom, for that. And yes, do check all that out at dailytechnewsshow.com. And thank you to our patrons supporting us every week, including our new patrons, Peter Shakeshaft and David Morris. Thank you so much for being with us and helping us finish this month with one more patron than we had last month. If you're not yet a patron, though, and like to get our ad-free extended version of each week's show, plus listen and interact with us live, as we have been doing today with a whole range of people, Ivar and KV, Luke, Richard, Stephen, and others have joined us to listen live today, then you can do so patreon.com/UK Tech.
Yes, and you can send us any comments you might have to hello@techpodcast.uk and follow us on Twitter. It's @textmessagepod to keep up to date with the most important UK technology headlines throughout the week. And thanks to everyone listening to us on our free ad-supported feed. If you have just a minute to leave us a review on iTunes, it's the best way of supporting us without spending a penny.
And speaking of spending a penny, I need to get out of this chair. So from me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
We will see you in a week, everybody.
We will.
You've been listening to Text Message with your host, Nate Langson. If you get value from the show, please consider joining our many supporters on Patreon. You can get access to a version of the show every week with no ads and as much as 40% more discussion every time. There's no obligation, so why not try a month by going to patreon.com/UK Tech or looking for the link in this episode's description.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.